is the way. Ordinary mind is the way, Meng Shen replied. Shall I try to seek after it? Joshu answered. If you try, you will become separated from it, responded Nansen. How can I know the way unless I try for it? Persisted Joshu. Nansen said, the way is not a matter of knowing or not knowing. Knowing is delusion. Not knowing is confusion. When you have really reached the true way beyond doubt, you will find it as vast and boundless as outer space. How can it be talked about on the level of right and wrong? With these words, Joshu came to a sudden realization. Mulong's comment, Nansen dissolved and melted away before Joshu's questions and could not offer a plausible explanation. Even though Joshu comes to a realization, he must delve into it for another 30 years before he can understand it fully. Mulong's verse, the spring flowers, the autumn moon, summer breezes, winter snow. If useless things do not clutter your mind, you will have the best days of your life. Some of you are here, I think, for the first time, and you might have recited sutras for the first time. If you recite sutras in our group, it might be a confusing experience, because you're reciting a text in a language you don't know, and that's really, for that reason, meaningless. At the bottom of each of the sutras, there's a small translation, a brief translation, and you can read that translation after the sit if you'd like. And you might think, this is really odd, you know. Why don't they simply recite the translation? In fact, many years ago there was a person who was sitting with us for a little while, and he wasn't really very happy with the style of practice in our group, and he went away and practiced with some other group, and later he came back very briefly, and he noticed that we were still reciting these sutras in the phonetic transliteration. And he laughed and he said, are you still reciting those sutras in Japanese? I said, yes, we are. The interesting thing was that even if you were Japanese, these sutras wouldn't make any sense to you. The sutras that we recite, for the most part, are Japanese phonetic representations of Chinese phonetic representations of Sanskrit texts, which were themselves translated probably from the Pali, from the language of the Buddha. So really, almost no one who recites these understands what they mean. And this is a great opportunity. If you were tied to the meaning of the text, you really couldn't experience the kind of consciousness that sutra recitation is designed to help you reach. Now, when you recite sutras, you want to recite them from deep in your abdomen. So you want to reach down into your dantian, into your hara, and squeeze the hara from as far down as possible as you recite the sutra. And you're basically allowing the syllables to flow out as you breathe out. When you run out of breath, you take an inhalation, and then you go back and you follow the syllables out again, or you allow the syllables to flow out again. This is really a wonderful experience. It has nothing to do with conceptual meaning. In other words, there's not a message there. There's not a message. There's not a, or at least there might be an unstated message, but there's no stated message there. You're just breathing rhythmically and paying attention, very close attention to the syllables themselves. And you really have to watch, you know, and we move pretty fast. So you have to focus your mind. You have to try to get each syllable correct. And you breathe, you're breathing from your abdomen, you're breathing from your hara, your dantian. And we're moving right along. Some of them are almost ridiculously fast. And if you try this, if you really give it a try, I think you'll be surprised where it takes your mind. You know, there are some schools of Buddhism that don't really do much seated meditation, zazen, as we do here. They do sit on a cushion with a pad and often on some kind of a bench. But they recite sutras like this for many hours. They've committed whole sutras to memory, and they just recite syllable after syllable after syllable for hours. And remarkably, they may have studied the sutras, they may know their content, but that has nothing to do with what happens as they recite these. You know, you sit down on the cushion, you're working with the breath, the syllables are coming out, and on some days, you know, you might just be tired, and this might just seem very rote and uninspiring. But if you're really trying, you're focusing the mind on the syllables and you're breathing properly, you might begin to feel a kind of opening up in yourself, or a kind of expansiveness, or a kind of energy. At first, when you're reciting the sutras, it's a labor. It can be a labor. But as you go along, you might feel almost that you're being carried through the process. And there may suddenly arise a kind of spontaneous energy or spontaneous joy and a sense of openness or freedom. You know? This is quite familiar to people who have practiced for a long time and who Buddhists who practice what's called Nyenfo, sutra recitation, you know, love this, know about this, and love this aspect of their practice. There are many different kinds of consciousness, and this kind of consciousness that we enter into, or can enter into, when we're doing something like reciting the sutras in this way, is distinct. And our word for it in Buddhism and in Zen is samadhi, samadhi. Ordinary consciousness is characterized by a kind of distrust, shall we say? Distrust. You know, sometimes it's okay to distrust. But ordinary consciousness is based upon the idea that we have to exercise a kind of vigilance or a kind of caution. And we also have a kind of critical attitude towards things as they're unfolding around us. Basically, it's a distanced perspective, you know. The perspective of somebody who's thinking, who's analyzing, or who's observing in like a reflective mode is a distanced perspective. And, you know, sometimes it's important to get a kind of distance on things. I think that, you know, science is really a wonderful human achievement. And I think it involves distance, creating a distance between yourself and the thing you're observing. You know, scientists use this distance to understand the properties of things. You know, I'll never forget when I was a little boy reading in a biology book about a stomata on the bottom of leaves, those little holes in the bottom of leaves. Like everybody else in the world, I had looked at leaves hundreds of thousands of times. When I was a little kid, I liked to go out into the woods. In the fall, I liked to jump into piles of leaves. But it had never occurred to me that leaves had tiny little holes under on their undersides that allowed them to take in oxygen. It just CO2. It never occurred to me that this was the case. I was reading this book as a kid, and I can just remember being astonished that there were these little holes. Somebody had reached this discovery, achieved this insight by creating a kind of distance. You know, we're all experiencing leaves all the time. But you know, if you take out, you create an experiment and you have a microscope and you look at leaves under the microscope, you get a very different view. It's not the ordinary view. And you discover something new, and that's a real achievement. And that's a kind of knowledge that's difficult and really worth it, you know, very important. You know, if you read old literature, you know, people had all kinds of crazy ideas about how the body works. There were people who thought that the cycles of the moon affected the flow of blood in the body. That's not, many really learned people used to believe that the motion of the moon and the stars created like the sloshing around of blood in the body, and that it took a long time for somebody to investigate how the body works, to do anatomical studies of the body, to cut it open and look at it. And I remember being in class in 10th grade, and we cut open a frog and looked at its heart. And I kind of regret doing that now. At the time, I had seen frogs, you know, many, very often, and when I cut the frog open, I was looking at the frog in a whole new way. And of course, I saw its beating heart, and I put nitroglycerin on its heart. You know, that's a kind of knowledge that comes from creating a distance or a sense of separation. If that had been my pet frog, I never would have cut that frog open. There are actually companies that raise thousands of frogs and ship them all over the United States to high schools in Spanish moss, and biology teachers take them out of the box and give them to their students. It's a kind of knowledge that comes from distance, and it involves questioning, calculation, some kind of almost like distrust, right? It's like there's something here that I need to know that I don't know. And there's a kind of it's almost like distrust. I don't want to be negative about it, but a great deal of many wonderful things have come out of this kind of separated awareness, this kind of deliberately distanced awareness. You know, much medical knowledge, understanding of economics, understanding of medicine. So there's a real place for this. There's a real place for this. But on the other hand, you know, there's this other kind of consciousness which is not so valued by our society. And that's this consciousness that you enter into if you're reciting sutras. You know, you might think to yourself, this is really stupid. Really, I mean, and indeed, it is in a certain sense really quite stupid. You know, there's no intellectual content to reciting the sutra. There's nothing really to be, aside from exploring the process and the change of consciousness, there's nothing to be discovered, right? What happens in the process of reciting the sutras is that you begin to feel this sense of openness or connectedness or a kind of energy. And that's really marvelous. It's a different kind of consciousness. You know, sometimes these two kinds of consciousness can go together. So, you know, I've known people who are very good, you know, discriminating. They have very good discriminating minds, very good distanced minds. You know, they might be, you know, philosophers or scientists. And when they do their work, they really are able to be sort of separated observers. On the other hand, you know, when they do this work, they also get this feeling of openness or connectedness. You know, so I think these two states of mind can sometimes go together. You know, but I think they're a little different. And in our culture, we really don't value, I think, enough this experience of being, of stepping outside the boundaries of the self and being or feeling intensely connected to the world in a non-discriminating way. You know, this is really quite central to Buddhism. And it's quite central to Zen. It's really the goal of Zen practice. And, you know, it's really, even though we don't value it in our society, it's probably the foundation of our relationship to the world. You know, somehow, you know, when we're growing up, things happen to us that undermine our trust in our trust. I was watching the other day a movie on the Discovery Channel. I have a story to tell you, but I was stuck in the hospital recently, and I wasn't prepared to go to the hospital. Nothing happened that was bad, so I don't want to keep you in suspense. But I was stuck in the hospital waiting for a test, and I had not expected to do this, and so all I could do was watch TV for hours waiting for this test. So I could control the TV, and I went to the Discovery Channel, and there was a program on some Amazonian Indians. And, you know, these Indians had quite a wonderful life. You know, it showed them they got up and swam in the river, and they went hunting, and they had the house, and the house had beds, they had hammocks. And I don't want to idealize them and say they had no problems. I'm sure they had many worries. But I was struck by how simple their lives were and how well adapted they were to their circumstances, you know, to their environment. And it's so different, I think, from the modern world where, you know, our world is so complex and it's so challenging in so many levels. You know, we have to, on our jobs, usually we're usually paid to do some kind of, often people are paid to do some kind of work where they have to use their minds. They're paid to be thinkers or observers. You know, we have to generate information or, you know, translate information, digest information. You know, there's a lot of stress on ideas, thinking, criticism, analysis, and those are all good things. But you know, I think we have forgotten that there's a kind of foundation to all the other kinds of awareness, which is this relationship of trust in the world, this sense of connectedness or of being at home, at homeness, you know. And when I was watching this film, I was thinking, you know, these Indians, you know, they feel at home. I mean, the jungle, this place in Brazil, the Amazon, is all they've known. You know, they have dependable food sources, and they have pretty lovely, I would say lovely, environment to live in. And they didn't seem challenged at all. They were laughing when they go out hunting. You know, there's always game. They have little gardens. Again, I'm not saying they don't have any problems, but I think they had, you know, maybe I'm fantasizing, but I think they felt a deep sense of trust. They feel a deep sense of trust. You know, they live in a world that seems very much to be their home. And I think modern people don't always experience that, you know, but it is like the foundation of our awareness, of our relationship to the world and to other people. And I think that sometimes, as we're growing up, very commonly, we can have that foundation shaken. Things in life can shake our foundations. You know, at some point, we begin to realize that, you know, we don't control many things in our lives, you know, life doesn't necessarily, life throws us curveballs, and we don't always know how to deal with it. And accumulatively, over time, this begins to produce a kind of foundational distrust. I was just talking to a good friend of mine who sometimes comes to meditate here, and she was over in England during the spring semester at, I think it's called the University, it's called Birkbeck College in I think it's in London. And she was in Great Britain, and it was winter, still winter, when she arrived. And she was with her daughter, and they were playing in the snow. And she did something that every little kid does, right? I mean, basically, there had been like a heavy snow. And even though my friend is in her 50s, she's in her mid-50s, she was in this moment of great excitement and trust. And she leaned back and she let herself drop into the snow. Right? And anyway, in the snow there was a bunch of ice. And her head hit the ice, and she said she heard a loud pop. And of course it hurt. And now she has tendonitis, and it won't go away. And now this kind of event, you know, these kinds of events happen to us all the time, right? As we're growing up. They have an effect cumulatively, right? Cumulatively. We've all had these events, you know. You go down to the pond, and you jump in the pond, and you hit a rock, and you break your leg. That happened to a friend of mine when I was a little kid. Or you go out to play in the woods, and you get bitten by a snake, something like that. It can be tragedies, you know. I had a friendship at one time with a woman who when I was living in New Mexico with a woman whose parents both died of emphysema while she was in high school. And I think that must have been so challenging to be a high school student. You know, most high school students are worried about their hair or, you know, their complexion. And they're worried about what other people think of them. And that's sort of part of the developmental process, you know. And instead of being worried about, you know, whether her sandals looked good or not, my friend had to come home from school and take care of her dying parents. You know, I think when I met her, she had just gone through a long period of depression. She told me that she got so depressed that she just couldn't get out of bed in the morning. She literally would just wake up and she just sat in bed all day. Somehow, she didn't tell me how, but somehow she worked her way through that very understandable period of depression. And when I knew her, I thought she was a really remarkable person. And frankly, I fell in love with her, you know. And she didn't fall in love with me. But I still have great admiration for her, nevertheless. I don't know how she did it, but somehow she was able to regain her trust. I think when people get depressed, it's because life has thrown them some kind of a curveball. You know, it's like you... It happens. You know, I had a friend who became very depressed when he was promoted to full professor. And he had been working so hard for 20 years. You know, I think he imagined that when he was a full professor, things were going to be different. You know, he was going to get up in the morning and go, "Well, I'm a full professor. You know, the coffee tastes better. You know, I'm getting along with my kids better. You know. I'm the sun is a little brighter, the grass is a little greener, you know, whatever." And, you know, he got up after being made a full professor and, you know, many of the same problems, all the same problems were still there, except now he was a professor, full professor. And I think he went into real depression, you know, because he had thought this was going to change things and maybe restore his trust. And it didn't have that effect at all. And so, you know, I think people get depressed when this fundamental trust in life is threatened or undermined. And then it's like being cast adrift because nothing can replace that trust. You know, getting to be full professor didn't solve his problem of distrust. It didn't fulfill that need. And you can read any book. You can read books, and you can do other things. But you know, sometimes I think we're looking in the wrong places for that deep sense of connection. You know, we're looking in the wrong places. I know a friend of mine, who, you know, likes to shop, and she told me that, you know, when she's feeling down, she goes shopping. I notice that she shops a lot. You know? So somehow it doesn't fully work, right? It's a short-term solution. I think she's looking for something that maybe the shopping doesn't fully give her. And I think my friend, when he was promoted to full professor, he was looking in the wrong place for something, which is this deep sense of connectedness, you know. And it can seem, if you're in the wrong state of mind, you know, this can seem really desperately missing, you know. And so you can, you know, you can, right, you can study, you know, Heidegger, you can take up painting, you can do all these things, and you might not be able to find the that connection, that basic trust, if it's been undermined in some way. So Zen is all about encountering or restoring that basic trust, you know. And it can happen. It can happen, you know, anywhere, anytime, so long as you're not grasping. You're not grasping, you know. Last night it was so interesting. I have been struggling recently in my job with financial problems. The division that I'm in charge of was about $200,000 over budget last year, unexpectedly. And so we're starting the new year, the new fiscal year, with a $200,000 debt. And so I have to make arrangements somehow to deal with this. And I don't know what to do right now. I'm troubled. And I know there's a lot of different people who want things. Nobody wants to give up things, you know. So if I go around and say, would anybody like to give up $50,000? Nobody's going to say yes, you know. I know I'm going to make some people unhappy. I know I'm going to, you know, rain on people's parade. I don't know what would be fair. Okay. So last night I went to sit. I went to the meditation here in this room, and I sat down on the cushion, and these thoughts were very much present, and I kept coming back to my breath and back to Mu. And when I left here, I was feeling much better. And then as I was driving home, you know, I stopped at a stop sign, and there were no cars around, and I could hear the insects, the summer insects, you know. And it was so beautiful. And I had this tremendous feeling of joy, you know, and freedom. You know, it was like I was a little kid again, and I was on my bicycle in Baltimore, you know. And I had, you know, ignored my mother, who was calling me to come home. And it was night, and it was a hot summer night, and it was like suddenly all my cares just blew away, right? And I felt this tremendous freedom and openness. And I don't think that's an illusion. I don't think it's an illusion. I think it's really there, and I think it's really there all the time. It's just it gets covered up. It gets covered up by clinging and fear. And I felt like a kid again. You know, I felt so happy. And I thought to myself, why am I feeling so happy? And I realized there's no reason for it, you know. I haven't solved any of these problems, you know. And I could say, well, I feel happy because I did Zazen, but why does doing Zazen make you happy? I think it takes you back to this foundational consciousness where our connection to the world becomes obvious and powerfully felt, you know. It's like going back to the most basic kind of consciousness, you know. And it's a wonderful place to be. So, you know, this koan is really all about that. Some of you may not know the story of Joshu and Nansen. You know, when Joshu is one of the greatest Zen masters of all time. And he, when he was only like 18 years old, he had what we call a kensho, or an awakening experience. He had a deep experience of samadhi, of connected awareness, and in which he became completely thoughtless.
And he became completely thoughtless. All his cares and thoughts were blown away. And there was just this overwhelming sense of connectedness to everything around him. And it was stunning. And when somebody asked him how he felt, he said, I feel like a ruined house, like a deserted house, which doesn't sound very good, right? But, you know, when the Buddha had his awakening experience, he also described it as like a house that had fallen down. He actually said, you know, there's a kind of, he said basically, builder, the house you built has fallen down and it will never be put up again. And that seems kind of puzzling until you realize what he's saying is that there's a kind, you know, there's a mind, there's a part of the mind that makes discriminations. It says yes or no, good or bad, right or wrong, successful or unsuccessful. This is that distanced consciousness. We build a house around ourselves, but actually sometimes we close ourselves in, you know. And when the Buddha had his awakening, he experienced this like a house falling down. And when the house falls down, you look up and you can see the brilliant blue sky, or you can see the night sky full of stars. So it's like moving from a place where you're kind of closed in, you're kind of boxed in, to this place where everything suddenly opens up and it's unbounded in all directions. See, that was the one aspect of the Buddha's awakening. And Joshu had that same kind of experience when he was only 18 years old. And he, of course, he said, "This is great. You know, what now?" And he decided he wanted to practice Zen to deepen his understanding of this open, spacious, connected mind. And he heard about a teacher named Nansen. And when Joshu went to study with Nansen, Nansen was in his 40s. And Joshu studied with Nansen until Nansen was about 70. And Nansen died. And Joshu then went all over China studying with other Zen masters. And he didn't settle down as the abbot of a temple until he was 100 years old. And he lived to be 120. So in this story, Nansen is still a student. And he's approaching master, in this story, Joshu is still a student. Joshu is still a student. And he approaches Master Nansen and asks him, you know, what are we doing on the cushion? What is this all about? He says, what is the way? What is this foundational consciousness? And Nansen says, ordinary mind is the way. Ordinary mind is the way. And Joshu, like everybody else, Joshu doesn't understand that there's this kind of foundational mind. He hasn't really appreciated this, you know. It's possible to, you know, we all spend a lot of our time, we spend 99% of our waking time thinking. And we're talking to ourselves in our head, or we're trying to solve, a problem, or we're projecting into the future, or we're recalling something from the past. And we're doing this all day long. Sometimes there are real problems. Sometimes these thoughts are like haunting us, right? We get caught in these obsessive loops where we can't stop worrying about something, or we can't stop thinking about something, or we can't free ourselves from some kinds of compulsive thoughts. Or sometimes we're thinking in order to disguise, to conceal our emotions. You know, we have all these different modes of awareness. But in most of them, we're thinking. And every once in a while, you know, we have this experience where we just become thoughtless. So, you know, you're on your way to work, and you have a 10 o'clock meeting, and or a 9 o'clock meeting, and you're racing. Then you get a call, and they say, you know, you're all dressed up, you're ready to go to your car, and you get a call, and they say, the meeting's canceled. Just wanted to tell you. So you think, now what? So you might sit down and in the backyard, and you suddenly hear birds singing, and you look down, and there's insects, and you might hear the wind in the trees, and your mind might just become thoughtless, right? And traditionally, in our culture, you know, to be thoughtless is thought to be stupid. But actually, you know, this thoughtless state is very receptive, very creative, very alert and connected. But we might get up and go, okay, I've got to get to work. And we might not appreciate what just went on there, you know, what just happened there. Because it might seem trivial. Oh yeah, I wasn't thinking. And you might get up from your lawn chair after that and think, and feel very good without knowing why. And then you get to work and, you know, there's all these emails and you might feel stressed or not, you know. You might not appreciate what just happened, but there's this kind of foundational consciousness that Joshu too doesn't fully appreciate yet. And he says, what's Zen all about? What is the way? And Nansen says, foundational consciousness is the way. Now, shall I try to seek after it? Joshu asked. If you try for it, you become separated from it. So as soon as you start trying, right, you're already creating a distance. How can I know the way unless I try for it? And Nansen said, the way is not a matter of knowing or not knowing. When you don't understand something, you're confused, you're puzzled, you might get angry, you might be frustrated. When you understand something, you control it, you fit it into a pigeonhole, you've made it predictable, and it renews what you already know, right? That's understanding is basically building on what you already know. Not understanding is being unable to integrate what has just happened with your prior knowledge. But Nansen says neither of these are neither of these are really foundational. You know, when your trust in life has been broken or undermined, these kinds of knowing don't really help. And so basically you have to look elsewhere for this foundational consciousness. The thing about it is it's always there. It can't be controlled. It doesn't conform to our expectations. It doesn't arrive on command. But when you stumble into it, you realize it's this wonderful, wonderful freedom. He says, the way is not a matter of knowing or not knowing. Knowing is delusion. That's what he says. He says, we create these little systems, we create these structures of thought that are pragmatically useful, right? But we know that water isn't really water, right? The word water is just a term. You know, H2O is just a term. There's something artificial about the way we label things and categorize things. It's functional, but it's a little bit artificial. You know. So he says, knowing is delusional. It's not real contact. And not knowing is confusion. When you have reached the true way beyond doubt, you will find it vast and boundless as space. How can it be talked about on the level of right or wrong? With these words, Joshu came to a sudden realization. Now, this is really the essence of Zen. You know, we come in and we sit down on the cushion, and basically we might have expectations about what's supposed to happen. Or maybe not. Maybe we just sit on the cushion and we're worrying about something, right? So maybe the boss at work gave us a bad approval rating, something like that. And you've been working hard and your boss wrote up a bad rating. And now your feelings are hurt, you feel oppressed because this is an injustice. You'll have to write a response which won't carry the same weight. You worry about your possible promotion or your possible raise, your future. You sit down on the cushion and it's all right there. And you watch your breath and you watch your breath and you watch your breath and it's right there. And you keep turning it over in your mind. You think of your boss, you can see his face, you might want to punch it, you know. You might feel hurt. Depending on your personality, you might want to beat him up, you might want to beat yourself up, whatever. But if you keep coming back to the breath, at some point, you know, you fall into this wonderful freedom. It doesn't solve the problem of your response to your boss, but it's a matter of stumbling into the essential connectedness of things. And when it happens, you know it. You know, you might not understand it, but I've had people who have been beginners at Zen, and after their first sit, they'll come up to me and say, "Wow, what was that?" And I'll say, I'll do a very bad thing, you know. I mean, if I were really a good Zen teacher, I wouldn't say anything. I'd just look at them quizzically, and I'd walk away, right? Or I'd put my shoe on my head and I'd walk out. But because I'm, so-so as a Zen teacher, I say, "Oh, that's samadhi," you know. So they go, "Ah, samadhi, now I understand." You see. But, you know, I'm not sure they would come back if I didn't say that. So, I could try the shoe on the head, but nevertheless, you know, even if I tell them it's samadhi, it doesn't really hurt things too much, because they know the word is not really the experience, you know. But people stumble into this foundational consciousness, and it's like, it's beautiful, and it's blissful almost, and it's like coming home. It's like being home, you know, safe, connected, at peace. You know. And it's very important to spend some time there. This is like medicine for us, you know, because there's so much in our world that undermines our sense of trust and our sense of confidence in things. And the more we rely on our discriminating intellect, you know, the less likely, you know, if it's very easy, if we live in the discriminating mind, to lose touch with this fundamental trusting relationship to the world. Some people are able to maintain it. You know, they had very good upbringings and they have a lot of confidence somehow. But it's very difficult to maintain that. And Zazen is like a medicine, because it's like, you know, you sit down and you reconnect with that, the universe, on this fundamental non-discriminating level. And I think it's quite important, you know, to be able to do this. This morning I got up very early and had my breakfast. My wife and I are an unlikely couple in some ways, you know. My wife goes to bed at 4:30, and I get up at 4:30. Right? So I love her company, but I only see her fleetingly sometimes. So this morning I was getting up at around, 4:30, 5 o'clock, and she would just come out of the shower. And I like to read Huffington Post, and she hates the Huffington Post. And I said, oh, I want to read you something from the Huffington Post. It was like, oh, no, no, not the Huffington Post, please. So, oh, come on, you know, all right, go ahead. So I was reading to her about the bombing in Norway, you know, and which confirmed her suspicions, right, that I was going to bring up some bad news as she's going off to bed, and the thing is, we got into this big discussion about how this happens, right, and we both had theories about free speech and limits of the law and blah blah blah, and we had a fascinating conversation. Actually, we had to cut it off because she was going to bed and I was going to Zen. But none of that really. You know, an event like this leaves a kind of wound that doesn't really solve, right? You know, we got into this whole thing about the limits of free speech. You know, do you let Nazi propaganda circulate because you believe in free speech, and I, you know, the Europeans say no, America says yes, and we got into this whole thing, you know, and then Barbara went to bed and I went to Zen. But you know, underneath it left a scar, because when something like this happens, you know, maybe consciously we think, oh well, you know, these things happen. But unconsciously, we think, what kind of world, you know, we feel undermined, right? I mean, I thought, you know, Scandinavia was this peaceful place where everybody was happy, you know, and I have never been to Scandinavia, but I always thought, you know, that I imagine it's, the streets are clean, the people are smiling all the time, they have a wonderful health care, they have good education, they all have straight teeth, you know. And you know, you see these pictures, and they look, everybody's healthy looking. You know, and it turns out not so. You know, and I always think of Scandinavia as like the place in the world that's really solved a lot of its problems. You know, they always score high on happiness, gross national happiness measurements, and you think, well, they've got it knocked. And it turns out that somebody is unhappy in their society and decided to shoot 60 people and so on and so on. And when, you know, when we read this consciously, we say, well, this has happened before. You know, these things happen. You know, we can deal with this. We have laws. We have theories of justice. We have to think about the limits of free speech and so on. But there's a bigger problem there. It's like it undermines your trust. I remember the first time I went into New York City as a kid with my parents, and we were in Penn Station, and I saw people sleeping on the ground, and they were in they were dressed in street people's clothes, and they had bags, and I couldn't see their faces, you know. And I just, you know, I mean, who are those people? You know, they're street people. Come on. But that, you know, you think, what kind of a world is this where people are left to sleep on the ground? Or what kind of world is this where people blow up government buildings and shoot a bunch of kids at summer camp? And we really don't, we know the answer intellectually, but it undermines our trust, right? And so, you know, for every time you read the Huffington Post, you have to do some zazen, basically, you know. Because, you know, these events leave a trace on the unconscious trace if they don't leave a conscious trace. And they add up to a sense of instability, or, you know, you get this feeling that everything's going to fall apart. You read about global warming, you see this violence, you see our incredibly terrible political system grinding on. And it's easy to get depressed. It's easy. But in times like that, more than ever, people need a fundamental sanity. It's like sanity is actually in short supply. Because once people lose connection with that fundamental trust, they'll do terrible things. And they rely on ideas too much, right? I mean, the guy who did these terrible things was really like an ideologue. You know, he has a whole philosophy and he wants to overthrow the existing society and so on and so on. You know, if people behave badly when this trust is lost, they'll do terrible things. And so it's possible to think of Zazen, you know, as the useless activity, right? You know, there's real problems in the world. Get off your ass and do something. But on the other hand, you know, acting from this fundamental trust is really, I think, very important. You know, you're not acting out of panic or neurotic fear or projection. You're in this very centered place, this very safe, stable, trusting mind. And in that state, you can be generous. You're not afraid. And compassion is ever present, you know, really. And I think people are likely to act more wisely if they're in this state. And you'll feel better too. Right? Joshu asked Nansen, "What is the way?" "Ordinary mind," Nansen replied. "Shall I try to seek after it?" Joshu asked. "If you try for it, you become distanced from it," responded Nansen. "How can I know the way unless I try for it?" persisted Joshu. Nansen said, "The way is not a matter of knowing or not knowing. Knowing is delusion, not knowing is confusion. When you have really reached the true way beyond a doubt, you will find it as vast and boundless as outer space. How can it be talked about on the level of right and wrong?" With these words, Joshu came to a sudden realization. Mumon's comment: Nansen dissolved and melted away before Joshu's questions and could not offer a plausible explanation, which is good. That's like when somebody says, "Wow, what was that?" You put your shoe on your head. Even though Joshu comes to a realization, he must delve into it for another 30 years before he can fully understand it. See, this is Mumon is testing us. This is another koan. Because it's not about understanding. You know, practicing Zen for a long time is going to this place of connectedness and trust, and then sort of like soaking in that beautiful water, soaking in that refreshing stream for 30 years. It's not so much understanding as letting it soak into your bones. You know, if you spend enough time with that in that trusting place, you know, it changes the way you interact with others, you know. It becomes your home. Mumon's verse: "The spring flowers, the autumn moon, summer breezes, winter snow. If useless things do not clutter your mind, you will have the best days of your life."